The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am excited to welcome our guest. Jamila Minnick's lyrical and rich debut novel, Moonrise Over New Jessup, tells the story of a 1950s era, all-black Alabama town that is resistant to desegregation and the opposing political viewpoints that threaten a young couple's burgeoning romance. Praised by Barbara Kingsolver for its dive into the deep complexity of the American Civil Rights Movement, by way of compelling characters in a heart-pounding plot, it won the 2021 Penn Bellwether Prize for socially engaged fiction. The book has also received stellar recommendations from authors including Tisha Filial and Robert Jones Jr., author of The Prophets, who writes, "I was awestruck by its beauty, rapt by its originality, and astounded by its depth. From page one, I knew this work would transform me. It expanded the way I imagine what is possible in the art form. Read this book, cherish it, protect it. You must." Right out of the gate, Jamila Minnick's Moonrise Over New Jessup is a masterpiece. The mic has been dropped. Please welcome Jamila Minnick's.
Good evening. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. Robert's words continue to stun me because I wrote this book about our family. So it's nice to see so many friendly faces, some family faces, all here tonight. So I wanted to talk a little bit about where New Jessup came from. A few months ago, I had the honor of spending 3 weeks at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. It's this really beautiful campus close to Sweetbriar College. It's about 20 miles from Lynchburg, Virginia. And Sweetbriar, all the land that VCCA sits on, all the land that the college sits on, was formerly a plantation. At emancipation, there were approximately 140 enslaved people who lived there. It's a mountaintop, and it's absolutely stunning. It's some of the most creative time I've had in my life, other than on my Auntie Jay's porch swing in Montgomery, Alabama. And one day I was taking a walk, and there's this beautiful field, and you can walk around the field, and there was this really ethereal mist, a low mist in the early morning. And it was such an ethereal mist, it felt ancestral. It felt like the 140 people who were there at emancipation, the countless other people who were enslaved on that plantation, were all lining up to say, "Tell my story next. Tell my story next. You told Alice's story, now do mine next." And it was so overwhelming to be there on that mountain, to have all of these voices telling me I'm next, that I thought, I can't possibly tell even these 140 stories, let alone the 6 million stories of enslaved people who lived in this country, let alone the hundreds of millions of black people who've lived in this country for 246 years since emancipation. So the question that raised to my mind was, if I can't tell them all, who can I tell? I'm one person. I don't know how many of y'all have had the opportunity to read Moonrise. I know you did. but I don't know how many of y'all have had the opportunity to read the book, but this is Alice's story from cover to cover, one woman. And so it had me out there thinking, if not everybody, then who? I say all that to say that when I started Moonrise, I started it knowing that my great-great-grandparents were born and lived enslaved in Marengo County, Alabama. Preston and Margaret Young. They were enslaved on a plantation owned by a man named Dr. Henry Fountain Reese. Now you say, it doesn't make sense. Their last name was Young, but they were enslaved by this man named Reese, and don't we all know that the enslaved carried the names of the slavers? But I envision that that Preston and Margaret at emancipation did as so many of our people did. When they were free, and they were free to be freedmen and women, they walked off as freemen. Or they worked the many, many beautiful waterways of Alabama, so they walked away as watermen. Or, as other documented people have walked away, when they took the name Young, they considered themselves, at emancipation, reborn into freedom. And so they became Young. And I envision what Preston and Margaret must have felt at the dawn of their freedom when they walked off the plantation and they said, "We're free, but what are we free to be?" So you'll notice, if y'all have an opportunity to read the book, that Alice's last name, her maiden name in the book, is Young. One of the many reasons I chose that name was because it was my mama's maiden name. Because from Preston and Margaret came O'Connor. O'Connor married Betty. And from Betty and O'Connor came John. From John and B came my mama Gloria. And from Gloria and Matthew came me. Alabama runs through my veins. And it was important for people to see Alabama as more than my Auntie Jay says. You better keep telling these people that Alabama is more than the Civil War and civil rights. That we love this soil. That the sin is not in the Tombigbee River where my mama was baptized. Not in the forests and the fields where my granddaddy grew his food and where my uncles and my granddaddy hunted. The sin in Alabama is in the hearts of man. So I wrote this book as a love letter to Alabama, to my family, and to black people in the South. I wrote this book because I wanted it to be a continuation of conversations that I had with my mama, who's long since gone now. I wrote this book as a love letter to us, loving the South. So Alice Young gets off the bus in New Jessup, Alabama. And Alice is what I know black women from Alabama to be. She's smart. She's curious. She's creative. She's determined. And she's resilient. And she knows her own mind. And she gets off the bus in 1957, Alabama, in this place where she, like my great-great-grandparents, is newly coming into this place where she's free to be. And she has a pretty stunning reaction. So if you'll allow me, I'll take us all right into Alice's experience as she gets to New Jessup. Is that all right? All right. The moon rises and sets, stitching eternity together, night by night. Love's spun thread binds family when even years or the blue sky stands between one and another's touch. Generations travel the same footprints, reach hands to the same climbing branches, and warm the same bronze skin under the Alabama sun. Now, maybe family brings to mind only blood, marital relations, and it's easy to understand that way of thinking. But love by my hands tethers generations to generations, as well as kin by skin, in this place where all in me and of me can thrive. But even the strongest thread will snap with constant tension and no slack. The heavens overflow with memories lost. Come on in, sit down, have a seat. So as life requires, I hold taut and I give. In some ways, my people know, if in some, they never will. But in all ways, my moon rises and sets for family. So, in eternity, the time had come for me to leave the home where I was born. The sun was setting, and the half-bald red sweet gum around the fields announced November, just a few days coming. But 1957 was still October old when my landlord found himself face down on the ground for trying to drag me behind him to the tool shed. I was the last to leave the home house in Rensselaer. Daddy had passed a couple weeks before, and I had settled him next to Mama, though his burial left me scrambling for the rent. My sister Rosie was living with a nice family in Chicago doing hair, and my need to keep a roof over my head had mellowed my worry to wonder about when her next letter would arrive. There was plenty of gleaning left to make November's payment, and then I'd scratch around for whatever came available to buy myself some time. I had never planned or wanted to leave Alabama, but with old man Todd shouting curses at my back, his face split open and gushing sweet gum red, my plans to stay began to fade. After a night at the neighbor's and an hour's long walk with the dawn, I arrived at the bus station with just my thrown together knapsack. The man behind the counter assured me that my little money would carry me to Birmingham, not Nashville or Louisville or Cleveland, let alone Chicago. Birmingham, he said, and no further. In the hours I waited on the bus to depart, the world came undone piece by piece. Unable to get to a place I never wanted to go, with ticket in hand to a place I knew not a single soul first, the landscape flattened. Direction was next, north, south, east, west, all headed towards the unfamiliar, and then finally color, till everything faded to black and white. I rode the bus into this flat, directionless, colorless world until it shushed to a stop in my new home. Not that I knew it at the time. No, my ticket read Birmingham, and all I knew was that we had stopped somewhere between nowhere in particular and the big city. We had traveled 100 country miles, or maybe 10, stopped once, twice, four times, I don't know. I was huddled against my window, watching the world blur by as the man seated next to me kept up one-sided conversation about returning north after visiting with his wife and children down country. Somewhere along the way, he started worrying me about the brown paper bag on my lap and the chicken grease soaking through to my dress, but that oily stain hardly ruined anything. The gray threads had known color when I first sewed it, red plaid. That stain just turned light gray to ash and ash gray to black, so somewhere near Needham, I offered him the chicken. He took it and finally left me alone. We shushed to a stop and the bus emptied, some getting off, hugging loved ones hello, some taking luggage from the belly of the bus, and most everybody stretching, smiling, and laughing underneath the blue sky day. But the stops were all the same to me, so I stayed inside with my head against the glass, feeling the sun's warmth against the window. And that's when a red-heeled shoe clicked its way up the sidewalk. Two of them, if I'm honest, so it wasn't so much the shoes that caught my eye, but the bronze stocking legs inside them. They continued up their way towards the sidewalk cafe before disappearing through the front door. My eyes traveled from the cafe to the paved sidewalk to the row of brick front shops lining the wide avenue. The sun gleamed from the white tile at the bus depot, and a polished chrome dog leapt over the door. A couple folks, one like me, the other nothing like me, looked around unsure what we were seeing. When the man seated next to me returned smelling of cigarettes and shoe polish, he urged me off the bus with a dime from his own pocket. "Miss, our next stopping for quite a while, and this here's a good place to stretch your legs. Why don't you go on inside and get yourself a Coca-Cola before we pull off again?" Before stepping foot to pavement, I hovered in the doorway of that bus. To the left and the right, the sidewalk, the storefront extended to the horizon in either direction. But reaching the front door of the depot, the colored entrance was nowhere in sight. To my right, a shoeshine man chewed a toothpick while studying the shoe and the polish in his hands from every angle. Behind me, from the bus window, the man urged me through the door, only the last thing I needed was to be arrested just for going through the front door to buy a Coke. "Help you, miss?" asked the shoeshine man. So the words eased from his mouth, he'd done his level best to ignore me. With the weather-beaten hand-me-downs on my feet, it was no wonder why. "I'm looking for the colored entrance, please," I said to the pavement, not wanting to be pegged ignorant of city ways and where they hid the Negro doorways.
"You won't find one of them here," he said. "Just walk in."
"I'd prefer the colored entrance, please," I insisted. He seemed an unusual man, perhaps a prankster of some sort, with the long limbs, triangular head, and bulging eyes of a chameleon. Just the sort to make trouble for folks and dart away. We ain't got one of them, because ain't nothing but Negroes in this town, is what I'm telling you. Look around and see if you see any white folks other than these sorry few from the buses. He smirked and returned his attention to the shoe in his hand, satisfied he knew the lay of the land. A dark brown man sold bus tickets and answered questions inside, while two soldiers in army-issue khaki rushed past me, one with a deep mulberry skin of the ruddy harvest, and the other, my same sun-gold cinnamon with dark freckles on his cheeks, who placed a hand to his peaked cap. A light-skinned woman with a wild mane of bottle-red hair rushed into a yellow cab, driven by a portly man of pecan complexion. He sped past an ebony police officer in white gloves holding palms up, meaning stop. A deep bronze man across the street wore pink-covered bib overalls, smoking a cigarette next to another bib-overalled man, Coco Brown. And the family by the drink machine? Well, the mama, she was high yellow, but her husband was rich, deep brown to match some good peaty soil. One child favored him, one her, and one fell to a brown somewhere in the middle, and that was just within those few feet of me at the depot. Up and down the avenue, Negroes of every shade came together like the dusk in a fall forest. I should have been glad, relieved to find such a sight on my journey. My knees gave out and I sank onto the bench next to the shoeshine man. I buried my face in my hands and sobbed. "Ain't our folks' usual reaction when they first arrive in New Jessup," he said, patting my shoulder with the light taps of a man unaccustomed to comforting people. I stopped crying in time to wave the bus off, too exhausted to shed another drop. "Is there a church house nearby?" I asked. "Pastor and Mrs. Brown will take right good care of you up at Morning Star Baptist," he said, and with walking directions, he sent me on my way. But after I took a couple steps up the sidewalk, he called out. When I turned, he spoke to the stain on my dress and the marks on my arm. That weariness had me forgetting to hide. "But, miss, if you're looking for white folks, and I don't imagine that you would be, but say that you are, well, you'd have to get all the way to the other side of the woods to find a single one." So, welcome to New Jessup. New Jessup is inspired by the more than 1,200 black towns and settlements that we've had that were founded right here in the United States between the late 18th centuries, and we even had one, Freedom, Georgia, that was founded in 2019. These are places where black people run the businesses, we own the homes, we're the teachers, we are the doctors, we are the lawyers. And in this place that Alice finds on her journey, she's so overwhelmed by envisioning a place where she is free to be, which to me is free to be black, and to be smart and determined and creative and to know her own mind. And she's free to be all these things in a place where she's discovered she's also free to be vulnerable. She's free to find people who are around to support her, to help her make her way. So Alice, this story follows Alice because Alice moves to this place and she's going to fight fiercely to make sure that this place is available for her children, and her children's children. Now, I talked a little bit about my ancestry earlier because that blood, my blood, runs deep in me. My ancestors are people who never in their lives knew my name, but I believe that they had the hope that if they built and they made a way out of no way, that their children and their children's children and their children's children's children and so on down the line would find a place of safety and comfort here on soil that they built and places they left for us. It's important because in New Jessup, what is centered is blackness. One of my favorite write-ups about New Jessup came from Lene O'Neill at Anscape. She said at the heart of it, Moonrise Over New Jessup is a book about black people minding our own black business. And I love that, because it's true. It's absolutely true. In New Jessup, we were black people minding our own black business. In Eatonville, where Zora Neale Hurston grew up, we were black people minding our own black business. In Hobson City, Alabama, we were black people minding our own black business. Now, that's not to disavow anti-blackness and white supremacy, because that's as American as apple pie. But what I will not do is limit discussion of those topics to south of the Mason-Dixon and east of the Mississippi, because that runs all throughout this country. But when we talk about places like Eatonville, when we talk about Tulsa and Greenwood, I want us to talk about blackness and excellence and what my ancestors built for us. It breaks my heart to talk to people about Greenwood, to talk to, you know, we have conversations about New Jessup, and they say, yeah, we had Greenwood, but then they took it away. And my first question is usually, what did they take away? And the answer is Black Wall Street, right? Like, some of us grew up hearing the stories of Black Wall Street and Rosewood and Wilmington and other communities like that where we had black excellence everywhere we looked. Baptist Hill in Demopolis, Alabama is the place my mama bragged about. I always say my mama wasn't who she was despite Alabama, but because of it. So when we talk about Greenwood, people say they took it away. I say, what did they take away? And people don't know. They don't know that it was founded in 1905. 1905 to 1921, in 16 years, Greenwood was so built up. They had schools and churches, of course, because in our community, those were the things that our people wanted and prioritized. They also had savings and loans, hotels, candy stores, theaters. And the thing that always hits me right in my gut, and I can't tell you why, except that the technology must have been so still relatively new and so expensive. They had photography studios. Studios where black people were taking pictures of, you guessed it, black people. Where we dressed one another. We encouraged one another. We lived on streets where everybody knew if you got an A on a test and everybody knew if you were up to no good. And so when people come to me and they say they took it all away, I say, what did they take away? Because one thing that my mama used to sort of drill into us is that if you can't love me while I'm here, if you can't appreciate me while I'm alive, don't have my name in your mouth when I'm gone. You need to understand her, and what I took from that was that we need to understand and center ourselves in our stories to make sure that when we're talking about our ancestors and elders, the people who built, that we're giving credit and uplifting the excellence and the perseverance and the love that built, that these people built on top of, that was the foundation of what they used to build these spaces for us so that we can all be sitting here today. I'm tired of people elevating white racist violence when we talk about Greenwood and Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's not that we don't acknowledge and hold people accountable, but I take a lot of inspiration from the survivors, some of whom are one of whom I think is 107 years old, in litigation that's still ongoing in Greenwood. And what are they asking for? Reparations, so that they can put that money back into the community. They cared about their community to build it. They cared about their community to thrive. They cared about their community to rebuild it. And they've cared about their community to keep the story alive all these years. So when we talk about black towns and settlements, I want us to elevate our greatness, to say to our elders and ancestors, we see and appreciate and acknowledge the love and the hope and the sacrifice that you all use to give us space to breathe. America is imperfect. I'm the first one to tell you that. I worked in a job where I saw some of the nastiest, most ugliest reasons for racial discrimination laid out on a table in a brief. You can't get me to say that America has reached any form of anti-racism. But what I want us to do, what scholars who have come before me, whether it's Toni Morrison or Du Bois or Booker T. Washington or any number of scholars, present, past, future, have asked us to do, is to elevate and celebrate blackness, to center us in our own stories. So I thank you all for giving me this space tonight to talk about Alice and New Jessup, about the reasons why I wrote the book. I thank you all for giving me a space to see my family and my family, my blood relations and my kin by skin.
Well, I read your book and you did it.
Y'all, this is my cousin.
Yeah, I saw family there, but I saw a love story about black people that was undeniable, even with the fear and the racism, the intelligence, the beauty. It was all there, and the prose.
You. Did you recognize Uncle John?
Uncle John. I saw Nanette B. I saw Deborah and Teresa. I saw Youngs. I was like, I'm her cousin.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, yeah. So I saw all of that, and my God, you know, it was beautiful. So thank you.
Thank you.
From family.
I just have a question. Is it fiction or no?
It is fiction. It's inspired by my family. But there are anecdotes in the book that only my family will recognize. Philip!
Are there any characters in the book that you see yourself in, perhaps Alice?
You know, Alice is, I will say, Alice is based on all the women in my family. I like to consider myself a woman in my family. So, you know, I think that there are traits that follow us generationally, right? That maybe an ancestor 4 or 5 generations ago had that now we have. So there's a part where she's in the book where she talks about there's somebody in history, in eternity, with whom maybe I share a laugh or a turtle birthmark, right? And she doesn't know. But I think that we carry the traits of our family, and we just may never know.
Is this your first book?
Yes.
How long did it take you to write it?
2 months for the first draft. And then, but hear me out. So I would say that. So I say that, first of all, you got to know my family. this story was right here. It was like I talked about the field and the sort of, this story was always right here with me. I don't know that I was equipped to write it before I started it. I started it in the summer of 2020. But it was always like, it was always right within my sphere to grab. And so that's why it took 2 months. It took another month to edit it for the Bellwether Prize. And then it's taken, you know, you go through the editing process. So I think that I turned in the final edits like 6 months ago. So, hey guys. I did not set this up, so I don't know what the questions are.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I'm not going to say anything really about the book because I haven't read it yet. I wanted to wait to the final and buy it tonight and have you sign it and all that kind of stuff. I want to say two things. One, I want to say that I am so proud of Philadelphia.
Yes.
You guys showed up, and this is someone who is new, and you came out and you gave her a listen. And I am so proud of Philadelphia. I really am. So thank you for that. And Jamila. Jamila. Grew up on this story from her cousins. From her aunts and uncles. And so I'm not surprised that it only took you 2 months because that story was in your heart.
Absolutely.
And when you read this, you could see it was in your heart. So I'm proud of that. But she's also a journey woman. I met Jamila. I'm not a cousin. I met Jamila when she was in college. And she came up to Philadelphia, drove up by herself from Michigan, mm-hmm. to go to the Million Woman March, mm-hmm. the march that they had in Philadelphia. And I was part of that journey with her. And I liked this kid. I mean, I just liked her from day one. But I've seen her mother died young. And I've seen her go through that grief. I've seen her go through law school. Mm-hmm. I've seen her graduate law school, mm-hmm. and make a successful law career. I've seen her open up her own bakery. She went to school while she's working as a lawyer to learn how to bake, mm-hmm. and opened up a successful bakery. And then next thing I know, she wants to write. And she writes in 2 months this story that was in her heart. And so I want to say that you talked about your ancestors, and you talked, because I knew your ancestors, some of them. Mm-hmm. And you are a product of them, from what I know. You are a product of that love, but you are also a product of Jamila Minix. And I just can't wait to see what next journey you take us on. You know, I love you, Jamila.
I love you, Teresa.
Hi, Jamila.
Hey, guys.
Wow. This is a really good book. I just started it, and every word is just so luscious, and I love history, and your words are magnificent. You know, I'm really savoring the book. So congratulations. And I remember you as a little girl, and I remember one family reunion with your mom, and I just thought she was so beautiful. I was like, she's in our family? I can't believe this lady is in our family. Wow. She was just a magnificent human being. But I have a copy, and I brought another copy tonight. I have, you know, it's funny. We're related on my mother's side, but on my dad's side, they're from Alabama.
See,
and he died when I was 2.5. So I've never been to Alabama, actually.
You need to go.
Yes, I definitely have to get some of those cousins. Somebody, I need to go down there with somebody. But I started reading my aunt, which is his sister. She's 99, mm-hmm. debated, maybe she's 100. And I started reading her the first page. And when Alabama popped up, her eyes lit up.
Yeah.
And I said, you know what? We're going to read this book together, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really going to be healing. She just lost her daughter, my cousin. And I just think it's going to be a beautiful book. She still reads. And we're going to read it together.
Oh,
thank you for this gift. Congratulations.
I get it on my Kindle.
Yes, it is available on Kindle.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I have some irons in the fire, but I think right now I'm going to let Alice and them sort of stretch their legs. You know, the book's been out for about, 4 weeks? I think so. I want to let them, you know, breathe a little bit. And I have a, it's all new. So I have some virtual events coming up. I have some cities that I'm going to be revisiting. I have some new cities that I'm going to be visiting. So the book tour, I think, is going to go pretty much until May, somewhere around there. So just, you know, what I'm enjoying is getting out and paying honor to the people who led to me. Because these are folks that never would have asked for a thank you. They just did what they had to do in the beginning. You know, they talk about in the book, everybody when they're in the swamp and they have to build from a swamp, everybody's out there with equal opportunity to get sick, get snake bit. It's not a matter of like philosophy and all that. It's like, we need to get to work. And so this very much feels like paying honor to people who never would have asked for anything. And that's been really the greatest joy, to see Black kids and parents. And when I was in Fairhope, a sister came up with her three daughters, and they bought one copy of the book, and the girls are sort of grousing, we all want our own copy, whatever. And she said, what I want to do, and the girls were like 16 to like early mid-20s, so young women. And she said, what I want to do is I want one of us every night to read some of this to the others. So it was very much a communal experience for them to sit down and talk, for the generations to sit down and talk about these experiences. If my book can facilitate that even in some very small way, I feel like I'm just so overjoyed. I'd feel like that's the biggest blessing that I could possibly ask for.
When I went to college, people say, where are you from? Mm-hmm. I say, oh, I'm from Alabama. And I kept saying, oh, then I that with a banjo on my knee. But what your book did for me, I've always told everybody, I'm from Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of it, because there's a depth there that I could never really explain, but your book is a love story for that. It elevates the atmosphere that you feel when you go to Alabama. Because I have had people tell me, oh, I don't want to go there. Yeah. I don't want to go there. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm scared. I said, no, but it's a warm place. And what most people there will tell you is God's country.
That's right. That's right.
And that's beauty, greenery, as well as the heart of the people. Mm-hmm. So that's what I really, really appreciated, that you elevated that feeling that I had already felt, and all my friends know. They'll tell you she's an Alabama girl.
That's
so. So thank you.
Thank you, Coz.
Hi. I don't know Jamila. I don't know her from anywhere. I'm not family. But I just felt compelled to say something. Just listening to you speak, listening to you read the book. I have not read the book, but just listening to you, I'm going to buy it tonight.
Oh,
because
wonderful.
The words is just like, you know, you're painting a picture. And like the lady over there said about Alabama, I am one of those people that are like, yeah, I'm not going down there. I'm good. I've seen what they're capable of. And you spoke to that, talking about not recognizing these places, the South in particular, mm-hmm. for the atrocities that have happened to Black people, but recognizing the excellence. And if anybody knows me, I stand on Black excellence. I am a champion for it. And so I'm proud of this book. Though I have not read it, what I have heard, I'm proud of. More than being proud of the book, I'm proud of you. I listened to the other lady who talked about your excellence. And so I just wanted to highlight that. You are talking about the excellence of your ancestors, but it is shining through you. From the moment you walked in here, I'm like, oh, this person is, you know, you exude excellence. And that story you told, you have a story yourself. Imagine someone going to law school and then opening up a bakery of all things, and then from a bakery to a book. Like, that's a story in and of itself. So I just want to encourage you and lift you up and celebrate you for your Black excellence and for being that example. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I will say, so our cousin Bobby, the book had been mentioned in the New York Times, and so I was, I had a phone call scheduled with Bobby, our cousin, and so I said, hey, cuz, you know, I was like, did you see the thing in the New York Times? And he said, yeah, I saw it. Now maybe I have to start bragging on you to my friends. And this is after the Penn bellwether. This is after, this is like 2 or 3 months ago, right? I was like, you know, I feel like I am somebody, and here he is. So he said, I said, oh, you only now gonna start bragging on me? And he said, hey, listen, all this you're doing, uplifting the community in Alabama with your book, you're a young, that's what you're supposed to be doing. And he yanked my chain right quick. And so I appreciate and I receive y'all's blessings and the words that you say. That's not, I don't think it, I'm standing here by accident. I stand on shoulders. Who stood on shoulders? Who stood on shoulders? I had examples. My mama, I stand with her. So thank you for that. It means a lot to me, but I come from people who made sure, even if they didn't know my name, you think Preston would be like, Jamila? But they didn't know my name, but they knew that they wanted me to be here one day. So I thank you for that.
Well, I read the book. I might have been the first one if it's only been out for 4 weeks. And it is a beautiful book. It was, I loved every page. I couldn't put it down. I was just, my husband, who is reading it now, I was like, oh, wait till you read this book. It's the most beautiful book I've ever read. But I can tell you that the one thing is that it really highlighted the sameness that we all have. And coming from, we have a mixed racial family, mm-hmm. so we're aware of that everybody has a very shared experience. And I think there's lots of people that don't and don't appreciate that there are families and that they've got problems and that they deal with them and they share them with each other. And I just so appreciated it. And it was just a lovely, lovely
thank
book.
You. And thank you for saying that. A couple of weeks ago, I will say, I was speaking to a woman and she said, you know, you deal with all this so beautifully. And she said, but, you know, you should put a trigger warning in the book. And I said, well, what is the trigger warning? And she said, you know, when Alice, because it's not, Alice has a sort of health scare. And she said, you do that and you do all this stuff with her health scare, but then you put that on top of the racism. And I said, yes,
That's
right. Because what do you say to something like that, right? But I'm like, yes, there's such a sameness to our experiences, but at the same time, for instance, if you go into the hospital, we have similar genetics, DNA, whatever. We have the same body parts. But as Black people, we're subject to different standards of care. Where the medical equipment, like a pulse oximeter, doesn't read our pulse ox the same. So there are so many different ways that we experience what should be a same experience in such different ways. So I just, I'm so glad that you saw Alice and her family and just said, I see myself. I just hope that we all recognize that they're doing this and they're living these lives and making a way out of no way because they have to, but it's not easy. And it's not something that we do without sort of the specter of difficulty that we navigate. So, but I thank you for that. And I'm so glad you enjoyed the book.
I guess I can just echo everything she said, but I'm curious, this story was in you all of your life, and then in 2 months it poured out of your fingertips or mm-hmm. through a pen. What happened?
So many things. I mean, I had written a novel over the course of 6 months, so I sort of used that prior novel to teach myself craft skill. But that one was like 700 pages, and so I put that one aside. I'd written a couple of short fiction pieces, and then I was going to turn back to the 700-page novel that is still in a drawer somewhere, and I was going to revise it. And I was like, well, I'm just going to turn around and write this other short piece right quick, and it's going to be 1954, Alabama, my family, all debating the merits of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision. So easy peasy, right? I mean, it's a story that almost writes itself. But during the sort of envisioning of the story, I saw Alice, and she's standing at the side of the table, and she's holding a turkey. And she's, you know, there's Percy, who's got something to say, Pop's got something to say, Raymond's got something to say, Dot's got something to say, everybody else has something to say, and Alice is like, sort of standing there like, I know my mind on it, I don't need to say anything. And in a snapshot of that moment, that we all go through our old photo albums and we say, oh, that person's just really sharp, who's that? And we can name that person. That person has a nice car, who's that? Name that person. But in that snapshot of that moment, we'll remember everybody else around the table. We'll remember that the turkey was dry and that somebody put something in the mashed potatoes that they shouldn't have. But when we ask who's holding the turkey, Alice is the first one to be forgotten. And so I said, this is her book, this is her story, because Alice got something to say. And so once I did that, there was no stopping the words. The only thing that stopped me was work. So, you know, I had to wake up earlier and earlier every day and just to get it out, just because if nothing else, if this was just going to be a draft on my computer, whatever, if I was going to self-publish it, I thought I was going to self-publish it and just ride it around Alabama, ride it around to all our cousins and stuff, like giving it to people out of the trunk of my car. But if nothing else, I said, this story, her story deserves to be documented for true. There are a lot of books out here purporting to be about black people, but this is a book about us, and I wanted Alice's story to be told. Jerry!
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I wanted to know, I have not read the book, but I can't wait to read it. I bought my copy today. There is this, black people are sort of falling in love again with the South. Mm-hmm. We are experiencing a reverse migration. Mm-hmm. You know, we are leaving the big cities in droves and moving back down. And I'm thinking about this story that I haven't read, but I just really enjoyed hearing you, and I love to listen, so I want to get an audiobook. But I just want you to talk a little bit about whether or not this is a space where black people have healed enough, right, mm-hmm. from many, many generations of trauma to where we are now able to reflect back on these stories of love and on these stories of life and living, and even fall back in love with the places that nurtured us, even amid the terror and all of that. And I would love for you to reflect on that in this space and time.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we talk about healing with the South, we've had two waves of the Great Migration, and we've had several generations of folks who've come north for a better opportunity, for less racial violence, for all the things that we thought were, at some level, unique to the South. We find racial terror and violence in every state in this union, right? And, you know, I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and I said, you know, I consider, people always think about Alabama and call it provincial and quaint, right? I wonder why, you know, people say, well, people in Alabama think you don't need anything from anywhere else. You think this is the center of the universe, all this stuff. I said, I just left New York and I hear the same thing. So does that mean New York? I mean, no shade to New York, but, you know, does that make New York provincial? So, I mean, I think it's about finding what we need and really recognizing that the Great Migration wasn't so great for everybody. You know, I think everybody is really quick to pin the evils of this country, like I said, south of the Mason-Dixon, east of the Mississippi. And the atrocities that happened there have happened all over this country. The Red Summer happened all over this country in 1919. So I think that there are reasons, certainly reasons that people have trepidation about returning south. And I'm, you know, I'm cognizant of that. I practiced civil rights law in South Carolina. I'm very cognizant of it. But what I consider it a sort of like defiant love. for the place that not just, you know, we say black people built this country, obviously, but our ancestors, we still have land in Demopolis, Alabama, our family. You know, we still have places where our families live to this day, very much love to this day. So I think it leads to, it should lead to a fuller, more honest conversation about what black people are looking for, what we left behind. If we're looking for safety, if we're looking for fresh air, if we're looking for clean water, if we're looking for places where we have opportunities, if we're looking for opportunities to participate in the political process, what are we looking for? And what are we getting in the places where we are? And I think if you read texts like Charles Blow's The Devil You Know, he was like, I lived in New York City. My son was hassled in New York routinely. And so from New York to Minnesota to California to Colorado, all over this country, we're not, I don't think, seeing all of the benefits that have sort of been attributed to these places. You know, it's not, people forget that we had slavery in New York City too, and it didn't phase out until almost 1830. So I think when we have a conversation about the South, it just needs to be a fuller, more honest conversation about what black people are looking for, what we're running from, and what we're running to.
Hey everybody, I'm from Alabama too. I'm from Huntsville.
Oh, you're from Huntsville.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Huntsville.
My dad's from Scottsboro, and I grew up there, so it's nice to hear that somebody's writing about Alabama. I mean, there's several people writing about Alabama, but I never see them. I've been home away from home for a while. But I have a question about process. Mm-hmm. So when you said you wrote it in 2 months, mm-hmm. right? I'm wondering if you being a lawyer helped the process. Like, I imagine there was a little bit of investigative research that goes along with writing a book, but mm-hmm. I also think that if you're writing a story that was near and dear to you, that is so close and related to your family, sometimes that process can get in the way and you're just trying to reminisce about it. So I'm wondering which of those things, being trying to separate it, like make it a work of investigation, which is really hard to find stuff on Alabama. I mean, I've tried to do my research on the history of Alabama, and I grew up there going to public school, and they really do leave a lot of stuff out. Mm-hmm. So I imagine if somebody is writing about Alabama, if it's fictionalized, for me, I think it's either fictionalized because it's to protect some of the privacy of my own story, or it's fictionalized because that part wasn't told to me and I have to fill in the gaps. So mm-hmm. I'm wondering, how was that experience in writing the book? Did you use your skills as a lawyer, or did you have to resort to talking with family to fill those gaps?
You know, there are a lot of different ways. It's a great question. A lot of great questions tonight. There are a lot of different ways to sort of fill in the gaps. Certainly, you know, the genealogy. There's a woman who wrote a genealogy book about finding your genealogy in Alabama. To its credit and shame, Alabama had great property records, and so you are able to trace back. So that's one way. But Aunt Anne had all that information available. You know, that's how I learned a lot more about Preston than I ever would have known. But, you know, there are texts particularly about black towns and settlements. There are some really great texts about, for instance, like the Lowndes County Freedom Organization and how that came about, and SNCC, and it's sort of how it sort of created the Black Panthers right there in Lowndes County, Alabama. So there are some really great great research out there about particular movements or particular time periods. I obviously have such a great family who, like I said, they'll recognize like anecdotes or little jokes in the book that nobody else will know about. They'll recognize names that nobody would know about. But also, you know, Sadia Hartman talks about in Venus in Two Acts, she talks about this idea that there are people in our history that are being written about by not us. And so when they wrote the history, they wrote their version of the history. we weren't given that voice, that opportunity to do that. And so she sort of wrestles with, do I fill in the blanks? What's my responsibility? Fiction gives you an opportunity to expand and ask questions. So the reason I wrote New Jessup and didn't pin this on a particular town was because I wanted to embrace the idea of Black towns and settlements. I wanted to embrace Alabama, obviously, but I wanted to embrace a larger idea of Black towns and settlements. And so fiction allows you to do that without being pinned down to a particular incident on a particular day that would change the whole trajectory of your story. And with people, it's a little bit different, though, because even though these are fictional people, they represent real people to me. I don't talk about the people in the book as characters. I call them people because at some point they have traits of somebody who walked this earth at some point. So I think it's really important for us to be true to the time and how they would have acted, the attitudes, the clothing, the smells, everything. It doesn't give you as much freedom, but it also forces you into this place where you're examining the perspectives in a really true way and giving voice to people who really, really lived. So, you know, I would just encourage anybody who's like thinking about writing a book or who's interested particularly in historical fiction or fiction about us, about Black people, when you're writing, think about what it means. It seems like a radical act, but what does it mean to write a book about Black people minding our own Black business, centering us on the page? And you'll find that it really opens you up to a world of possibility that you never would have considered before. So, thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.